Good morning. The only word is wow. It's a stunning victory for the candidate few thought was predicted to win. Today, America knows its 45th president will be Donald Trump. We get analysis from Neil Conan and Ken Rudin this morning, and we get a reality check of Hawaii results. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. One of the documentaries in the spotlight at the Hawaii International Film Festival addresses the effort to save Bhutan's sacred arts. Princess Ashi Gesang Choden Wanchuk is in our studio to reflect on the precious legacy of 1,000 hands of the guru.
It's a Wednesday, November 9th, the day after the election. Take a collective breath. The conversation starts right after this news. Don't let me be misunderstood to start our morning.
Yeah.
And good morning to you and welcome to the conversation on this day after the election. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Yeah, as we reflect on the many things that we misunderstood, right?
Exactly the point. But, you know, we're going to find out more about that as time moves along. And, you know, this morning, today, we know the president-elect is Donald Trump. Few expected this outcome, except perhaps the Trump campaign. Earlier this morning, Hillary Clinton spoke to her supporters and called on them to keep building an inclusive America. She also called upon them to give Donald Trump a chance to make good on his statement last night to be the president for all Americans. But clearly, all who America encompasses was missed by her campaign. I spoke to the political junkie, Ken Rudin, right after her speech and asked him if this election was the pendulum swing of Barack Obama's election 8 years ago and whether we just got a serious lesson about who the discounted American voter really is.
You know something, Beth Ann, I'm still trying to calculate what lesson we did learn. What we did learn was that there was anger out there, there's dissatisfaction out there, there is a helplessness among people who have watched their jobs get shipped overseas, watched a foreign policy that doesn't seem to be winning. Donald Trump always liked to talk about, I am a winner, I believe in winning. We did not have a winning foreign policy. And, you know, for all the polls that showed Hillary Clinton had the lead and was, you know, energizing Latinos and African-Americans and women, there was an underbelly there that showed that maybe what we thought was there was not there, and that is that the anger superseded whatever good feelings people had about breaking history and glass ceilings and things like that. There are so many things that happened at the end. I mean, do we know what the FBI Director Comey's letter had to do with the campaign? Did it bring up a subject about emails that we didn't want to hear about? So, you know, you wonder what ultimately did it for Hillary Clinton. Obviously, it was so overwhelming that it's hard to point to one thing. But when you look at James Comey, you look at the rising premiums in Obamacare, you look at the leaked emails from WikiLeaks from her campaign, you just wonder that it just seemed to be, you know, an assortment of things that didn't go her way.
Aside from the gender issue, this was so characterized as being the elite versus working America. Was that too simplistic?
No, I don't think so. And that's exactly it. I think the establishment really took it, I think the establishment really got beaten up over this. And I think of what happened shortly after Barack Obama was elected in 2008, the rise of the Tea Party in 2009. There was an anger out there that something was happening in this country, whether it was health care, whether it was same-sex marriage, whether something was going on that people were not ready for. And when Mitt Romney lost in 2012, we say, well, yes, there is an anger out there, but I think that the feeling was that if the Republicans ever hope to win again, they have to realize that demographics were changing in the country, morals were changing in this country, viewpoints were changing in this country, more people of color, more women, more young people, things like that. But then Donald Trump fooled us all. He campaigned in states that we didn't think were possible to go Republican. Wisconsin hadn't gone Republican since 1984. Pennsylvania hadn't gone Republican since 1988. Michigan, as we're talking, is still we don't know what's going to happen in Michigan yet, and that is remarkable. And so all the things that we thought we knew, Hillary Clinton with a lead and gaining, Democrats possibly picking up the Senate, if not making big gains in the House, all of that was wrong, and we missed it. The pundits missed it. The pollsters missed it. I'm not convinced that even the Trump people realized how overwhelming this victory was. Or maybe they did know, but nobody else seemed to know.
Ken, you mentioned that polling was so inconsistent with the outcome. Except that one USC LA Times poll that used a different method, and they seemed, when it came out, to be, oh, they must be the outlier, and they turned out to be the only one that was right. Is this really a lesson for us in how polling should be done, or should we just simply forego polling?
Well, you know something, I've thought the same exact thing. I've thought that same exact question when that LA Times poll came out. Everybody said, oh, come on, you know, what are you thinking? And I don't know if it was a mindset around the country that people didn't want to believe it, but clearly they found something that nobody else found. And you know, there's some great pollsters out there, the New York Times, the Marist poll, the NBC News, the Wall Street Journal, Quinnipiac. I mean, there's a lot of very renowned pollsters out there who know their stuff. But, you know, I'm thinking of 1936 when the Literary Digest called people by phone and asked them who's going to win the presidency, President Roosevelt or Alf Landon, the governor of Kansas. And most people said Alf Landon. But, of course, what they did was in 1936 they called people who had phones, and only the wealthy had phones. And, of course, Landon won only two states in 1936. I don't know who was called in these pollsters. I don't know if there was a silent majority that we like to talk about, but when we saw those battleground states at one after another coming so close, being so close, it was just I don't know what another word other than remarkable.
The thing that seemed to be so striking about that USC LA Times poll was that it used a different method. It wasn't just asking up or down which candidate, but it measured over time with, I believe, the same people what their predisposition to vote for that candidate looked like in terms of percentages and their excitement over that candidate in terms of percentages. It seemed to suggest that people, in fact, you know, do shift differently and do have different feelings at different times, and it gave a different snapshot. Do you think that because this one seems to be the only one that was right, that we might see how polling is done in future changes?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I think everybody, including myself, are going to spend a lot of time reading up and studying that poll. You know, everybody was referring to Nate Silver, and Hillary Clinton had an 87% chance of being elected, and people were just, you know, like haphazardly looking at the polls. But when everybody seems to get it so wrong, and this one LA Times poll seemed to get it so right, I think all of us, pundits, analysts, pollsters, all need to revisit how we think elections are being held. And look, there were some surprising numbers we saw during the polls as well. We didn't expect Bernie Sanders to win in some states that he did in Michigan, for example. We expected Bernie Sanders to be closer in California, and Hillary Clinton won big there. So there's been surprises all around. Nobody envisioned Donald Trump. Certainly nobody envisioned Donald Trump having a shot for the nomination, let alone the White House. So everybody seemed to be wrong. And of course, you know, to paraphrase George W. Bush, we misunderestimated Donald Trump and the appeal he had for all these millions of Americans.
Last night, she didn't come out to, I should say, last night, Secretary Clinton did not come out to talk to her supporters. Instead, John Podesta came out, and he seemed so much like a cheerleader. He was so upbeat, and as if there was something, you know, different that was going to be happening today. And yet, when we heard her speak this morning, she was subdued, but she said, as in her opening remarks, that she hoped that Donald Trump really would be the president for all Americans. And she was urging her supporters to keep building a hopeful, inclusive, and big-hearted country. I mean, that seemed to be the theme ongoing, that America should be for everyone, and that, you know, if Donald Trump is good by his word to do that, that, you know, maybe this is a shot, but everybody has to keep pushing toward that goal. We don't know very much, though, about the policies that Donald Trump has in his back pocket to be able to make America for everyone. Where does this leave us now, except scratching our heads?
Well, of course, it's early, and we are still scratching our heads. And, of course, Donald Trump has said a lot of things that alarmed many Americans, including many Republicans, especially issues on trade. I mean, and his feelings about NATO and his claim that Mexico would pay for a wall, and his relationship, real or otherwise, with Vladimir Putin. I mean, there are so many things that alarmed and disturbed many voters, but obviously it touched a chord. So we don't know exactly what's going to happen. We don't know how to do. I mean, it's one thing to say, well, I'm going to get rid of Obamacare. I mean, I don't know if he could just do that, or maybe with an executive order he can make changes. My only point is that we don't. This is so uncharted territory. He was never specific. If you listen to the debates, and I'm sure so many people listen to the debates, and not just the fake ones on Saturday Night Live, but people listen to what he said, and they said, wait a second, nothing he says or little of what he says makes sense. So suddenly we're going to have to revisit what he said. He may even have to revisit what he said. And there are a lot of Republicans, such as Paul Ryan, who is still going to be the Speaker of the House for how long, we're not sure, but he'll be Speaker of the House. There may be a lot of Republicans who say, okay, he is the winner. We will have to work with him, and we're going to have to just dismiss a lot of the rhetoric we heard during the campaign and make something coherent out of all of this.
We've got to go in just about a minute or so, but I wanted to ask you, Ken, we now know that the Congress is going to be, you know, a GOP Congress. Is that going to make it a lot easier for Donald Trump to be able to lead? Or because of the splits that are still so deep within the Republican Party, is that going to make it perhaps just as difficult?
Well, as somebody wrote, told me this morning, probably somebody still in tears, they said, we've learned a lot of things. We, the Democrats, have learned a lot of things from Republican obstructionism with Barack Obama. There's no reason why we can't do the same kind of tactics with President Donald Trump, which is a sad thing because the gridlock and the ugliness will continue. But look, unless a president has 60 or more votes in the Senate, unless a president has a veto-proof majority in the House, there will be checks and balances. And I suspect that everything we saw the Republicans do to Obama, you'll see coming back to bite Donald Trump. We'll see a repeat performance by the Democrats.
Ken, thank you so much. We really appreciate the time.
It's my pleasure, Beth Ann.
Ken Rudin is one of America's foremost experts in politics and campaign history. He focuses on presidential elections, the races for House and Senate, and state governors. He also hosts the weekly Political Junkie program and is a contributor to many local and national public radio programs, including ours.
In Turkey, the government closed 15 media outlets. While Europe tries to make a threat that press freedom is a precondition to remaining in NATO, Turkey is having none of it. After the coup, Turkey goes its own way, raising tensions with its own allies. Does it mean Turkey can remain stable? Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:17, and coming up, restoring sacred artifacts in the Kingdom of Bhutan. But first, your quiz.
Mau, o ka ho'olawe, o Hawaii.
In today's backyard quiz, let's go outside and see a highly endangered native bird that's among the smartest of birds you'll ever want to meet. They have a wide variety of calls and vocalizations to communicate with others of their species and are skilled in using tools. Maui wildlife biologist Fern Duval has studied them for more than 30 years and was quoted in the Honolulu Star advertiser as saying, "They are the pinnacle of the bird world, the primates of the bird world, the gorillas, the orangutans, the chimpanzees. Their intelligence and social structure is unparalleled. The birds haven't been found in the wild since 2002 and have been kept from extinction by captive breeding programs managed by the San Diego Zoo, Global, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the State Department of Land and Natural Resources. This morning, we're looking for the name of this amazing native bird. We'll be back with it in half an hour, but you can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and the one to get it right gets a prize.
Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
The heritage of an ancient culture is priceless, but it's too easily lost. The fragile legacy of Bhutan's ancient religious scrolls called Thangkas, artifacts of the last existing Vajrayana Buddhist country in the world, is a legacy that's in danger of extinction, with only a few dedicated monks and a royal princess to protect it. Their efforts are the subject of a documentary being shown at the Hawaii International Film Festival, 1,000 Hands of the Guru, Saving Bhutan's Sacred Arts. Princess Ashi is with us in our studio, along with the director, Tobias Ravik, and we're going to tell the story behind this movie. Good morning, Princess.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for coming in.
No, thank you for having us here today.
A tanka is, it looks like a painting, but it's a form of storytelling, right?
Yes, that's true. It's like watching television now, but it was kind of like an old school television, and monks and teachers traversed around the Himalayan mountains to teach the public about Buddhism, actually.
And it each one has a specific narrative and a message, right?
Yes. Usually the basic theme is always about having love, compassion, and wisdom. Mm-hmm. But there are different deities and there are different lamas and spiritual lineages, so it kind of goes along those lines.
How far back in history do they go?
As far back as, I think, during Lord Buddha's time, which would probably be about what... Hold on, I think 500 BC. Ooh, that was the origins of Buddhism, but the Himalayan Buddhist practice was actually in the 8th century.
Mm-hmm. But extremely old, extremely rare, extremely valuable.
Yes, most definitely.
And of course, they're subject to physical decay, the original tankas, right?
Yes, so we have Thangkas as early as probably the 14th century at the moment. We haven't found anything earlier. But yes, definitely they're subject to deterioration.
What kind of work is needed in restoring them?
Well, I guess cleaning them up, obviously, because there's a lot of dust and smoke and things like that. And of course, painting them in. It's not like Western conservation. It's more about preserving the spiritual heritage, making it useful in terms of trying to use it for daily practice. That's the kind of thing that we're looking at in Bhutan.
So the act of restoration needs to be one that's done by someone who is in tune with the spiritual message, I would think.
Yes, so I think it is an advantage to have that. I mean, it's not necessarily something that's very vital, but I think it is definitely an advantage to have that spiritual background.
Why has it been as difficult as it has to get the older tankas restored?
Well, I mean, it's also to do with modernization, I guess. I mean, a lot of people just think of tankas more as an art form, not necessarily an object of worship. Mm-hmm. And in Bhutan, I mean, it's obviously an object of worship, but not really something to be appreciated for its art. And so we're trying to sort of put it in a modern context for younger people to sort of regain interest in that kind of art again.
In a way, you're saying that it is still a living document, not a historical artifact.
Yes, it's not a piece that you leave in the museum to be admired for its aesthetic appeal. It's more used for purposes such as festivals and rituals and prayers, as well as meditational practice, actually.
That being said, the aesthetic appeal is extraordinary. They're amazingly beautiful.
Yes, they are.
Tobias, how did you get onto this story?
Actually, it was in 2008 when the monks came to the Honolulu Academy of Arts, and Eddie Jose, who's the conservator who trained the monks, brought them over here for a training. Mm-hmm. And that's when I first encountered them. I was amazed by the artwork, and especially they painted some surfboards, and that really drew me in.
Oh, yeah. And instant Hawaii connection, right?
There it is. And actually, 3 years down the line in 2011, Eddie asked me to come and film a short clip to help the monks learn how to conserve the tankas so they could disseminate it across Bhutan without having to bring all the monks in. And that evolved and became the longer form documentary.
Sometimes I think the best documentary projects are the ones that start small and take on a life of their own, yeah?
Absolutely. And it's got so many layers, especially like the tanka themselves. It looks like a 2D object, but there's so much dimensionality to it.
Definitely.
That Ashi is very well versed in with the stories. Every little detail, she was saying, even the clouds have their own meaning, and the iconography is all very rich.
And that's what we were talking about before, Ashi, the whole idea of a painting as a narrative.
It's more a narrative in the sense it's not just a story of the historical and spiritual background, but it's also about transforming the mind. That's the main purpose of having a tanka, actually, the visual experience.
And new tankas are still being created, is that right?
Yes, definitely. But, I mean, the style and things like that obviously have changed over the years. So it's unfortunate to say it's kind of flat in its aspect. It doesn't have that depth and character to it that it used to, probably, say, in the 16th century or something like that.
That could be said of a lot of contemporary art.
Yes.
Sad to say, but... At the same time, you know, I wonder if modern society has, and this is a question I've sort of posed to both of you, has a real appreciation for ancient arts and what we can learn from them.
I think, I don't know. That's the question that we kind of worked with as well during the documentary. It was whether ancient art could still be relevant in modern times. But, I mean, if you think about it, especially the Buddhist practice, the spiritual art is to use to transform the mind.
Yeah.
I mean, we've developed in modern technology in so many ways. I mean, our ancestors wouldn't imagine what we're doing now.
Mm-hmm.
But in the aspect of being a human, we're still the same. I mean, we still get angry, we still get hurt, we still get sad. We haven't changed or developed in that way. So I think that artwork is still relevant in terms of helping to transform the mind into something better.
Well, yeah, that's there's nothing ancient about that notion, is there?
No, I think it's an age-old human thing where we just have these terrible habitual tendencies that we need to fix.
I don't see us getting better all that quickly, do you?
I guess not, but I mean, there's always hope.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just Buddhism, but I mean, in every spiritual practice, there's always hope, so I guess... There's a good side and there's a bad side to everything, so.
Very well said. Well, thank you, both of you, for coming in. It's a beautiful story and a beautiful film.
Thank you.
Thank you
for having us.
Her Royal Highness Princess Ashi of Bhutan is the executive director of the Tonka Conservation Workshop in her native country. Her work is featured in the documentary 1,000 Hands of the Guru, Saving Bhutan's Sacred Art, directed by Poonho grad Tobias Ravuk. The documentary looks at an art conservation program Her Royal Highness has created using monks to help restore ancient meditation scrolls called Tonkas, and you can see some examples on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Hawaii Public Radio gratefully acknowledges Julie Asari of Honolulu, Sarah Fong of Kaneohe, and Miley Tuwanik of Kapolei for their recent membership gifts. And thank you to all of our listeners for your support. If you've yet to join HPR, well, become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's easy, and thanks. And now back to our national scene. Now, in an upset of historic proportions, Donald Trump smashed expectations yesterday. You know that now. A candidate who vowed to overturn the establishment overcame every obstacle to win the White House. And while votes are still being counted in some states, he'll take office next January with the majorities in both houses of Congress. The vote represents a profound rejection of the establishment of both political parties, but Democrats in particular. News analyst Neil Conan joins us now from his Macnut Farm on the Big Island with an analysis. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So 24 hours ago, you and many, many others predicted a victory for Hillary Clinton. What happened?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We began that conversation yesterday by noting how wrong I was a year ago to dismiss the chances of Donald Trump as the Republican nominee, and I clearly failed to learn my lesson. To put it as simply as I can, his supporters turned out in record numbers, and Secretary Clinton's did not. She failed to motivate younger voters the way she needed to. She won big majorities of African Americans and Hispanics, but not big enough. And in the end, the college-educated whites I expected to repudiate Donald Trump did not. The women failed to support the first female presidential candidate in anything like the numbers I expected.
So do you think this is going to be seen as an epic failure by the Clinton campaign or just as a triumph for such an unlikely candidate as Donald Trump?
More the latter, I think. Now, Secretary Clinton obviously carried a lot of baggage into this race, but she executed a technically an admirable campaign. Now, she staged a terrific convention in midsummer. She built a formidable ground game to turn out her vote. She won all of the presidential debates. Obviously, she could not overcome a candidate who did everything wrong except the one big thing he got right. A billionaire from New York tapped into the anger that so many in middle America feel toward intellectuals, toward cultural elites on the East and West Coast, toward the forces of globalism, toward the growing numbers of Hispanics and Asians and blacks and Muslims, toward feminism and gender-neutral bathrooms, toward the political correctness they say permeating our culture. Donald Trump promised change, and more than anything, yesterday his supporters endorsed change.
While this has to be first and foremost the defeat for Hillary Clinton, it also, though, represents a repudiation of President Obama, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, what's interesting is his approval ratings are about as high as they have ever been. Both he and Michelle campaigned very hard to elect Hillary Clinton as a way to protect his legacy, to build on what he accomplished, and all of that now lies in ashes. The president-elect and his party vowed to repeal Obama's signature health care law, revoke executive orders on the environment, repudiate the climate change treaty, reverse policies on immigration, gay rights, abortion, gun control, voting rights, the nuclear deal with Iran, the entire progressive agenda lost yesterday. And President Trump is going to be able to appoint a Supreme Court justice to replace Antonin Scalia and restore the conservative majority on the court for another generation.
So, I mean, obviously, this is a major defeat for Democrats. But Donald Trump was also rejected by a substantial part of the Republican establishment, too. And so this has got to be a defeat for them as well.
Oh, that's a very good point. Many will get in line to kiss the ring of the victor. Some, though, will not. A substantial fraction of the Republican leadership does not see Donald Trump as a conservative, doesn't trust the promises of a man who changed positions and political parties, for that matter, so often. And they were frankly disgusted by his appeal to racism, to sexism, and xenophobia. And while he rallied the white vote to an historic win yesterday, many Republicans don't see how that can hold up in an increasingly diverse country. A triumphalist wing of extremists will now try to impose a radical populist agenda, and conservatives are going to have to decide whether they can live with that in full recognition that they have no home with the Democratic Party and that third parties have very little history of success.
And despite, you know, what he said last night, Neil, about, you know, reaching out to those who didn't vote for him and being the president for all Americans, President Trump, given, you know, the temperament we've seen of him, doesn't seem to be likely to forget those who didn't support him.
Within his own party, absolutely. There's the gamut from Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, who embarrassed Donald Trump by disinviting him to a campaign rally in Wisconsin in September. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell held him at arm's length. Any number of Republican senators and representatives openly opposed him. And virtually all of the Republican foreign policy establishment opposed him. And of course, that's just Republicans. This is a candidate who vowed to jail his opponent.
From the start, you know, we saw Donald Trump running his campaign on gut instinct. He clearly failed to prepare for the debates. For example, he rejected the conventional wisdom on building a ground game, you know, getting out to vote. He listened to very few people along the way. And now that kind of, you know, slapdash approach seems to have been vindicated.
I never thought he could win the Republican nomination that way. I never thought he could win the general election that way. But there's no reason to believe now that he will conduct his presidency in any other way. Donald Trump is utterly unprepared and unqualified for the job he's about to get. He has proven himself to be willfully ignorant, petty, vain, and as we mentioned, vindictive. There's a theory that, you know, men grow into the awesome responsibilities of the presidency the minute they step into the Oval Office, and I guess we have to hope that's true.
Now, we've talked about this before, but, you know, among other things, candidate Donald Trump questioned the system of alliances that have been the bedrock of American foreign policy since the Second World War. How do you think that might change going forward?
That's another good question. I suspect that he's going to try to reassure those allies now that he's won, but he raised fundamental doubts about American commitments around the world, and those doubts will not be easily assuaged. The eastern frontier of NATO, the Baltic countries, Poland, Romania, those countries have to be deeply worried. Germany, which has been able to play, you know, a muted role on the world stage in the shadow of American power, Germany may now be forced to assert itself as a leading power in Europe, with all that entails. Is the Trump victory going to further encourage Russian intervention in Ukraine? Will Japan and South Korea now seriously consider building nuclear weapons? What about Taiwan? If a President Trump tears up the deal with Iran, does Saudi Arabia try to build or acquire nuclear weapons? What happens to U.S. commitments in Afghanistan and Iraq? And how does a president who has vowed to crush ISIS in short order, how does he actually go about trying to do that? Now, Hillary Clinton essentially ran as a candidate of continuity, a steady hand on the wheel in foreign and domestic policy four more years, essentially. We heard all along in this campaign that she was swimming against the tide, but the American people wanted change. You know, and it's not just the change of parties that almost always follows a two-term presidency, but something close to revolution, you know, to dismantle a system that many middle Americans see as corrupt and inefficient, even though that system has delivered the most prosperous and powerful nation on earth. Exit polls clearly show that voters wanted a strong leader, and we elected a man with authoritarian instincts. So We're going to have to see how that plays out. Buckle up.
In her concession speech earlier this morning, Hillary Clinton called on her supporters to give a new president a chance to lead. She said that we owe him an open mind. And she also said in her phone call to the president-elect that she offered to work with him. Do we have any idea whether he will take her up on that offer in an effort to sort of mend those divisions that showed up so clearly in this campaign?
No idea whatsoever. You know, I think many of the supporters who chanted lock her up would be deeply disappointed by any gesture of reconciliation. But who knows? He may respond positively to what I thought was a very generous speech from a candidate who did, after all, win the popular vote and could have continued the, you know, scorched earth rhetoric of the campaign. And President Obama followed that with his typical class by saying, you know, now we're all rooting for Donald Trump's success.
So does the President Trump enter office with a mandate?
I think he does on two issues, on immigration and on trade. That vow to build a wall on the border with Mexico was at the heart of his campaign from day one, and the vow to renegotiate NAFTA and abandon the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement was at the heart of his appeal to voters, to workers in the Rust Belt, and they were the voters who gave him the margin of victory in, you know, Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Ohio. Repudiating the trade agreement, well, he can do that with the stroke of a pen. That's within the power of the presidency. He's going to need Congress if he wants to build the wall, but he can simply direct federal agencies to change the way they enforce immigration laws on deportation, for example, to revoke President Obama's executive order that protected the so-called dreamers, the people who were brought into the country illegally when they were children.
So what about the ban on Muslims?
I don't know what his position on that is anymore. He's changed it so often, but I expect he'll clarify it before he takes off.
What do you think will be his very first test?
Well, he's got a tremendous challenge to staff a new administration. The problems of transition are enormous, and I think President Trump will be tested once he takes office from both sides, by protests from those who opposed him, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, for example, and by extremists within his own coalition, you know, the Bundy family, for example. They're the people leading the fight against federal ownership of land out west. Two Bundy brothers and their allies recently won acquittal on charges arising from the occupation of a federal wildlife preserve in Oregon. So what does President Trump do if they occupy a national park? Now, there are also extremists in the Republican caucus in Congress. Does he work with the Republican leadership to try to rein them in, to control them, that very same leadership that dissed him during the election? Or does he encourage them to, let's just begin with the perjury charges against Hillary Clinton.
You're right. I mean, there's so much to talk about. But before you go, because we've got a little bit of time here, I wanted to ask you about the fact that we seem to get this so wrong. And just to kind of bring this back to the beginning of our conversation, with the polling that we all kept looking at, and I talked about this a little earlier with Ken Rudin, I'd like to get your take on it, with that USC LA Times poll that was the outlier when it came out, and clearly now the only one which got it right. What do you make of the polling methods that they used, and do you think that polling is going to have to really change to better assess who American voters really are?
The way it would have to change is to essentially spend more money, and that's hard to see. Most of the public polls that we see, the ones that are, you know, published in the newspapers, are sponsored by newspapers and broadcast networks, and those people are spending less money to take polls because those industries are not exactly thriving at the moment. The methodology used in that USC poll in Los Angeles was questionable all along. What they did was they, as opposed to going back to new randomly selected people, they kept the same panel of people and went back to them over and over and over again. There's some problems with that methodology, but clearly other people are going to try it. As you say, they're the ones who got it right, but there will be others who say that, for example, the people at 538, Nate Silver, got it righter than a lot of other people. He gave Trump a much better chance to win yesterday morning than most others did, maybe a 30% chance.
Right.
And 30% chances come in every once in a while. So it's the campaigns also who spend the most money on polling and have the most sophisticated operations. And the campaigns, there's every reason to believe that both campaigns got it wrong. Their private polling, I think yesterday we heard right at 7 o'clock, I was a senior Trump advisor, said they're going to need a miracle if they're going to win this. That was somebody who clearly looked at the Trump campaign's own polling, and, miracles happen.
Evidently. All right, Neil. Well, listen, thank you so much for all the time this morning. I know you've been doing lots of interviews throughout the day, and we appreciate the fact that you gave us so much today. And there'll be much more for us to talk about in the weeks ahead, but for now, maybe we all just need to take a breath.
And maybe another cup of coffee.
That too. Thanks, Neil. Neil Conan is our news analyst, and he usually joins us every Tuesday. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio. Hawaii elections paled in comparison with the presidential contest. Still, though, for Hawaii lawmakers who kept or lost their seats, it was an important evening. And then there were the constitutional questions and the Honolulu Charter amendments, with a reality check roundup of all of Hawaii's elections last night. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Last night and into the morning, I might add.
Yeah, which is why we're all like a little bit on the tired side today. But, you know, there weren't a lot of surprises in any of the federal contests. I mean, clearly things lined up very much the way that we had talked about it for a long time. Were there any real surprises in this election for you, aside from maybe, you know, what happened in District 9 with Stanley Chang beating Sam Sloan out of his Senate seat?
Well, there was also a Republican House seat that was lost, Feki Poha, hope I pronounced that correctly. So you actually saw not only the state Senate becoming all Democrat, 25-0, but it's now a 45-6 split in the House. So Democrats picked up in both chambers here locally. You've also got to look at Oha, if the numbers hold, and I believe they have. Kali'i Akina has upset longtime incumbent trustee and a former chair, Honani Poliona. That is bound to make some waves on the Oha board. But Bob Lindsay, the chair, did survive fairly handily over Mililani Trask. So those were some of the races that just kind of stood out. Briefly on Kauai, Gary Kuzer, the council member, lost, and Don Couch on Maui. Those were two longtime incumbents as well, losing their seats.
So, you know, when we look at how maybe the balance of power is shifting in Hawaii, I know the Advertiser had made that as part of their conversation, why to support, say, Sam Sloan, being that now this is going to be the first time since, what, at least 25, 30 years or so since we've had an all-Democratic Senate?
I cannot remember. In my time covering the Senate, I remember at least three and maybe even four Republicans. And until finally it dwindled down to just Sam Sloan. And in the House, it was even up, I think, at one time to double digits. Don't quote me on that. But, I mean, this is in sharp contrast to what happened nationally with the Republicans controlling all three chambers and a good chunk of the governorships and state legislatures as well.
So, you know, this doesn't bode well for Hawaii's Republican Party, but it, too, felt such a split over, you know, the national election. I remember talking many times with Beth Fukumoto Chang about Donald Trump not being, you know, her candidate, and seeing the real split there with the, you know, Republican Assembly and then Hawaii's GOP. What do you think happens now as we try to go forward?
Well, certainly that faction of the Republican Party that supported Donald Trump, they did prevail earlier in the caucus in March. They had a great night nationally last night. That's going to embolden them. Whether that, I guess the way I would put it, it is whether Trump supporters represent a majority of local Republicans, I think, remains to be seen. There were a lot of Jeb Bush folks, a lot of Marco Rubio folks, a lot of Ted Cruz folks. And if you add up the math, you got to wonder. Having said that, a win is a win. And whether Republicans locally decide to come around, that remains to be seen. And of course, that's going to depend a lot on how President-elect Trump does in office.
Meanwhile, we have pretty much the status quo continuing along with Honolulu's mayor, Kirk Caldwell, won handily, and Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro also the same. Let's focus a little bit on all of the questions that folks in Honolulu were asked to answer.
Yes, and I won't answer all 20 of them. There were so many, and I think it was overwhelming, but there were at least five that I think got most people's attention. And,
yeah, let's
and
talk about the Police Commission Authority one first.
Absolutely. It was a very resounding victory. This calls for giving the police commission greater authority over HPD, over the police department, including firing and hiring the police chief. And as we have long talked about on your show, there are all sorts of problems at HPD and with the chief, Louis Kealoha. So this is really something that will bolster the police commission, especially with folks like Steve Levinson coming on board as a new appointment. The term limits, on the other hand, rejected pretty resoundingly. Yeah. You will not extend from 2 4-year terms to 3 4-year terms, Honolulu mayor, Honolulu city council, and the prosecutor. That means, by the way, that the city prosecutor continues to have unlimited term limits, if I'm reading that correctly. Quickly, the multimodal transportation system. That's
overwhelming.
A mouthful, but
yeah.
Basically combining the management duties of HART with the handy van and the bus. That's something that Mayor Caldwell and his transportation department sought. It passed.
But also a lot more teeth for HART and the authority in their board.
Well, yes, but it's essentially to take away from HART going forward. It'll still be involved with the construction, the building of the project. But this is something that looks ahead to when the rail should be completed, as we all, well, I won't say we all expect it to be. But the idea is to have the proper governing agency within the city once HART is done with its mission and the train is up and running.
And we also are going to get an Office of Climate Change, Sustainability, and Resiliency in Honolulu, too.
That's something that Mayor Caldwell strongly supported. He got the backing of the Sierra Club in part because of that, this recognition that so much of Hawaii, particularly Honolulu, is on the coastline, and climate change is a reality, despite what some people still maintain. And that was considered a victory for environmentalists. I think the other one I would give attention to is the zoo. As you know, our Honolulu Zoo is struggled with accreditation, number of problems. This would actually dedicate a portion of revenue from the city coffers to keep the zoo running in order to get its accreditation. So that's a victory for those folks who support our Honolulu Zoo. Modest as it is, it's a wonderful little jewel.
And really, really quickly, both of the constitutional amendments, both of those passed, expanding the scope.
Well, actually, no, I have an update on that one. Excess revenue, the one that requires excess revenue and state money to pay off bonds and health and pension benefits, that did pass. But the jury trial constitutional amendment did not pass. It was a complex formula. You had to divide no and blank votes from the yes vote. So bottom line, yes on excessive revenue, no on the jury trial.
So very different from what we're seeing on the printout from the Office of Elections. Thanks very much.
And that was my, yeah. You have to apply a formula. I called the elections office just this morning, and that's what they told me directly.
All right. Thanks very much, Chad. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to you really soon. Every day, Chad Blair joins us with a reality check from Civil Beat.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. What would you do if I said right now on Kauai, there are about 4,000 kids living below the poverty level? That's nearly 16% of all the children on the island. Many of them go hungry every day. Do you think someone should do something about this? Linda Garrett thought so. She feeds 405 kids every week, and you wonder, how can she afford to do that? Because of the Annie Sinclair Knudsen Memorial Fund, that's how. It was established at the Hawaii Community Foundation by her granddaughter, Ruth Hanner. Linda Garrett was the recipient of some of these funds, so in 2005, she and her husband were able to found the Mobile Munchies program. They began by providing 36 meals per week, and that number has grown. These days, they make 405 nutritious brown bag lunches and deliver them every Thursday to kids in low-income housing and to some after-school care programs and the Boys and Girls Club. And so far, they've served 180,000 lunches. Just think how many people they could help if they provided two lunches per week. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Theater Center, presenting the Modern Maori Quartet, featuring show band hits and pop music in the style of Rat Pack crooners, with a Maori twist. 4 p.m. this Sunday, hawaiitheater.com.
I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll delve into the world of esports and fantasy football.
We've invited two companies in the latest Blue Startups cohort to explore this growing market and the path to profitability.
That's today at 5 on Bite Marks Cafe.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about a native bird species that is being gradually restored to its native habitat as a result of a captive breeding program that began in 2002. Over the past season, 19 new chicks were born, and wildlife biologists plan to introduce selected specimens to the Pu'umaka'ala Natural Area Reserve near Hilo. Because birds raised in captivity lose their instinct to avoid predators, the birds slated to be reintroduced have been retrained in predator avoidance. And scientists are building an outdoor flight aviary for them, and a lot of hopes will ride with the alala, our Hawaiian crow. That's our quiz for today.
And Dr. Stan Rises knew the answer, called us from Kailua, as did a lot of people about this quiz. It was very popular, but he was first, and he will get the prize.
All right.
If you've got a quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. We're coming up on, actually, it's 8:57 now, and before we go away, just a couple of thoughts from you as we were all watching the races yesterday.
We really know so little about what the country is going to be like from January on, far less, I think, than in any election in my lifetime, where we have a pretty good idea because of, you know, the traditional tools of American politics, a platform, an ideology, a party, party set of criteria, etc. We don't really know what those are.
We do know, though, that there's still a lot of anger, frustration, fatigue, and fear.
That we know.
We're seeing a lot of that on social media. And there's going to come a point where we're just going to have to, you know, get over all of that and be willing to move forward, because that's how time moves.
That's how it's supposed
to work. And
time
is running out for us, too, so we've got to say goodbye to you for the moment. But with all other things that are going on this week, it is also Fashion Week. We're going to talk with Toby Portner about what Hawaii fashion is really doing these days.
And we're going to meet singer Rachel Flowers tomorrow morning on the show. Email for us is talkback at Hawaii Public Radio. You can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation, our BKOZ HPR.
And our talkback number is 808-792-8217. If you missed any of this show or want to hear something again, just look under under Talk Shows for the Conversation on our archive on hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vanderkoot.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning right back here for more of The Conversation.